Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Your Booked. I'm Daisy Buchanan, your host, book inspector and disgraced reading monitor. I got fired in 1993 after hiding a copy of It's Not Fair by Belle Mooney for my own personal use. I have no regrets and Kitty is still my spiritual beacon. Firstly, my book, The Sisterhood, A Love Letter to the Women Who Shaped Me, is published by Headline on the 7th of March. And as a Your Booked listener, you can pre-order it from themargatebookshop.com and get 20% off site-wide when you use the code BOOKED at the checkout. Now on to this week's guest. We're talking to the author, critic and journalist, Hannah Beckerman, whose new novel, If Only I Could Tell You, has dazzled and captivated readers, including Jojo Moyes, John Boyne and Marion Keyes, who cried. It's about a family being torn apart by secrets and finding connection after decades of tension and separation. As the eldest of six sisters, I thought the sibling relationship was painfully accurate and beautifully described. It made me weep too. Hannah is also a professional book addict. She's a critic for The Observer, The FT and The Sunday Express, as well as regularly contributing to Sarah Cox's BBC Radio 2 show. She's a frequent judge, panel host and festival guest, and she spent time with Philip Roth and Jackie Collins. Hannah is also one of the greatest cheerleaders for books, reading and writers that I have ever met. Here's what we found on her shelves when we visited her in West London. We're here with Hannah in her study. It's a really, really beautiful room. You've got a gorgeous desk.
How many thousand words do you think that desk has seen?
Well, in tweets alone, probably a couple hundred thousand.
So we're around, I know you've got a filing system here, so some of these books are books that you are reviewing. Really gorgeous fiction.
So where you are now, you are in the kind of books that have made the grade. So, I mean, you know this, Daisy, you get sent, 40-odd books a week? And so I have my shelf of books that I am likely to review, organised in date order, like the obsessive that I am. And then basically everything else in the house has sort of made the grade. We now have a one in, one out policy because we are now out of shelf space. So these are either books that I have read or that I am certain that in, this is basically my retirement pile. So they're books that either I've read or that I'm certain I will want to read at some point in the future when I'm no longer working.
So can we talk about kind of you as a book reviewer and how long you've been reviewing and sort of how easy or difficult it is to separate reading for pleasure and reading for work, and I suppose whether reading for work is pleasure.
There is no reading for pure pleasure anymore. So I can't remember the last time I read a book that I wasn't working on
sad,
in some way.
Or is that just the inevitability of being a sort of freelance writer? And
I find it quite
novelist.
Depressing, I'll be honest, because, you know, but I mean, not least because when you're on Twitter, on social media, there is noise about a certain book that you really might want to read. And if you can't find the time to be part of that conversation, there is a kind of sense of sort of bookish FOMO that I get. So there is that sadness. And also, I mean, I suppose there's also the other side, which is when you're getting commissioned to write reviews of books, they're not always books that you would have necessarily chosen to read yourself. So I would say probably a third of the reading I do a year are books that I probably wouldn't have otherwise read. Well, and you know, there are books that I have been asked to read that I've heard nothing about that I have then absolutely loved. So there's a book I'm looking at now called Did You Ever Have a Family? It's over there. It's kind of the red one, right on the corner, by Bill Clegg.
I can see it.
that. So which, I've not heard of this book.
It's absolutely devastatingly beautiful. It's about a house fire and the fallout both in the community and within a family. And I, as I said, I'd never heard of it. I got asked to review it, and I became sort of slightly evangelical about it because it's just one of those books that I just found so moving. There's a writer, so she's got another one coming out in March called Eilet Gundagoshen. She's an Israeli writer, and I interviewed her for The Observer. Again, never heard of her. She's got a new one out called Liar.
I don't know if that's because that's a proof and whether the cover will change much for the real, but you know, don't judge a book by its cover. I always do. I love that. It's a gorgeous, very millennial pink, upended sort of strawberry ice cream cone.
Very millennial, but also very, very Farrah and Ball.
Yeah.
It's got that kind of muted it's classiness to it.
But if you went into a pub and you saw that on the wall, you'd know you were going to be okay. You'd know there'd be.
Yes, or someone's house. You'd be like, they're going to provide some good nibbles before dinner.
Posh olives.
Yeah, exactly.
Best kettle chips.
But no, so she wrote a book called Waking Lions about immigration and Israel that was just so moving. And again, I just would never have found her if I hadn't been commissioned to interview her. So there is that side of things. So for every kind of book that I read that I might not have wanted to, there is the kind of undiscovered gem.
What were you like as a young reader? Were you always someone who loved books and was sort of seeking author books, or was there a particular book that absolutely sparked it for you?
No, I was quite a bookish girl. So we didn't have, I had a friend when I was at school, and her parents both taught at the local private school. And whenever I went to her house, she had one of those houses that was just full of books. So you walked up the stairs and, like, you know, there were just piles of books. And to me, it was like heaven, because I grew up in a house where we didn't have lots of money and we didn't have lots of books. And my mum took us to the library every Wednesday morning, which was market day. So you'd go and, like, get your market shopping, you'd go to the baker's and get your bread, and then you'd go to the library and get your six books. And so I did read, you know, six books a week from the library. And we were a kind of bookish family in that way, in that my mum was encouraging us to read a lot. But we didn't have a house that was full of books. And I still remember with such a kind of visceral sense, that sense of envy of going to my friend Charlotte's house where she had books everywhere. And I always vowed that when I was growing up, I would have a house that was full of books. And if I had kids, I wanted them to grow up in a house that was full of books.
And you got your dream. Three floors of books. Although when the post comes with sort of 1,000 jiffy bags every morning, like, oh, be careful what you wish for. What were you getting out of the library?
I was getting out lots of Enid Blyton, whether it was kind of Secret Seven or Famous Five. You know, I loved St. Clair's and Mallory Towers. In fact, I've found my old, they were next door in my daughter's bedroom, I found my old, now battered copies. You know, when you really love books and you get them for your birthday after you've read them 18 times from the library.
Do you have a favourite? Because I think people tend to either Mallory Towers or St. Clair's. Don't you know, you sort of, you read them both, but you...
I think at the time I preferred St. Clair's, but in retrospect I think Mallory Towers are better books. Daryl's a much more interesting character than the twins. Much more interesting. Although I was thinking about this morning, and I was trying to remember who was the girl in St. Clair's who comes in, I think in the fourth or fifth year, and she's really, really angry, and she's quite kind of manly in her, like she's quite kind of strong. And she's saying,
Wilhelmina.
Or was it Bobby? I was trying to remember this morning. Wilhelmina? Anyway, and she's the one, there's a fire, and she goes and rescues someone from the fire. And then when she comes back, obviously they all like treat her as a heroine. And then it transpires that I think her parents have got divorced or there's some kind of sort of family stuff at home. And I just remember that character so well. And I don't think I understood at the time why I sort of empathised with her or why I cared about her. But she was so sort of vulnerable. And, you know, she stuck with me for what, like nearly 40 years, which is incredible, I think.
Funny, isn't it, how I think you instinctively reach for the books you need and you really hone in on the parts of books that you need, and you know what's going to nourish you, and you keep it close to you.
But also, because it's, you know, if I think about me as a child, my worst thing in the world would have been being sent to boarding school. You know, I was a really homely girl. I was really close to my mum. If someone had said, you're actually going to go to boarding school, I would have just wept and wept and wept and probably run away from home so I didn't have to go.
And yet I asked my mum and dad if I could go after reading Mallory Towers. And they, I mean, I don't think they had the cash for it, but also like, what's wrong with us? Why do you want to leave?
Well, but that's what I sort of don't really quite understand about sort of my fascination with the St. Clair's and the Mallory Towers. And there was another series called the Trebizond Books by Anne Rigby.
I loved those books. I loved Rebecca and her tennis career.
And her tennis career, exactly.
What I really liked about her as well was, typically you've got a heroine or a main character who's like a scholarship girl made good. So the non-boarding school girl can kind of, you know, relate a bit. Because if you're reading the books, you're probably sort of, you think yourself, you know, you're quite bright. Like, oh, I could get a scholarship if the school existed. But Rebecca's experience was very different. And she was sort of sent there, you know, through her dad's work. And she maybe wasn't super academic or super anything, because the tennis stuff happened quite late. I think if I was like, oh, she's a tennis pro, but not for me. Sex was sort of vaguely present in Trebizond. Because do you remember?
I think you might have found it. I didn't.
Well, there was Ingrid, the Swedish exchange student, who got told off for going off with boys and like sunbathing in town in a bikini. And everyone was like, oh, Ingrid, there's something up here. And I think Rebecca had a boyfriend.
I don't remember that. Robbie. I remember Claudine in St. Clair's being like the French circus girl.
Yes.
Who was basically kind of like exotic but slightly kind of suspicious because she came from a circus and everyone looked down on her because she was basically kind of common circus girl. All the class
common
stuff in
circus
those.
Circus girl who could run to the fees. Did she come in on a horse? There was a real... Ooh. I think the trope, the... undiscussed trope of boarding school girls fiction is someone always comes into a room on a horse.
Someone always burns the toast for the prefects in their first year.
And they're ragged. There's ragging. I never quite understood what that was. Because did you read The Naughtiest Girl in the School?
Yeah.
Where they're all sort of, they have like a school council and it's supposed to be very, very fair. I mean, like, looking back, I think that was Enid Blyton showing her distaste for communism. I always ask this because I'm really curious about it. Were there any books that you read as a child or as a teenager where you were acutely aware that perhaps you shouldn't be reading it?
Or the contraband reading.
Yeah, parents or teachers might be like, oh, what's that?
Well, I think not even might be. So when I was in the third year junior, so what would we have been then? About nine or so. Someone got a hold of a copy of Forever by Judy Blume.
Oh, it's funny because that is the one that comes up.
Doesn't come up a lot. And basically, she was called Nicola, and the deal was that you were allowed to keep it for one night only, and then you had to pass it on to the next person. Because there were, like, you know, what, 15 or 16 girls in the school to get through. So you basically had this book that you had to squirrel away from your mum, not read it, obviously, during daylight hours, read it at night in the dark with your, like, your torch, and then hand it back the next day.
So every day there'd be one girl in the class sort of bags under her eyes, be like, I've not been to bed, I've read Forever.
Well, and also just like feeling a bit discombobulated by reading about stuff that wasn't really appropriate when you were nine.
So I quite like the idea that that it was that organised, and that it's, did people respect the system?
It was almost like a sisterhood. It was
without really
wanting to do a pun about your book. But it was almost like that we weren't really sharing a book, we were sharing kind of contraband stuff about sex that we knew we shouldn't be reading. But there was a very much a sense of kind of a sort of sisterhood about, you know, we're all going to learn about Ralph.
Because I think that so often, even, you know, when you are nine, because I think in some ways nine is young, but then, you know, there's a wider world and there's plenty of stuff you don't know. You sort of, your knowledge isn't finite and there's all sorts of weird adult stuff happening that's there to discover.
Well, and also, I suppose, because, I mean, it probably was slightly kind of intimidating. You know, there are these teenagers who are kind of embarking on sort of sexual exploration and, you know, having names for penises. And, you know, that could, I think if you were doing that on your own and you weren't able to then talk about it and all be slightly embarrassed and intimidated together, it probably would have been a lot weirder.
Oh, good. So there was some sort of post-book discussion, like, what the hell was that? Because I remember reading all sorts of... Virginia Andrews is another one that sort of, that comes up a bit, and quite a lot of it just being like, I know that's a sort of mad kinky thing, but I don't really know what it is. I just know it's in that pile of knowledge that I don't quite have the wherewithal to process yet.
I mean, actually, my favourite Judy Blume is Deanie, the one where she has to wear the back brace and her mum wants her to be a model, and then she has to wear this back brace to cure her scoliosis for 4 years. And her mum still is saying, you know, 4 years' time, I want you to be a model, and she doesn't. She wants to kind of go into orthopaedics. And for me, there's something so much about kind of parental expectation and female empowerment and teenagers being uncomfortable in their own bodies that I just loved about that book.
Do you have any favourite book parents or villainous book parents? If you could be adopted by any parents in a book.
Oh, golly, that is a tricky one. I mean, I mean, my favourite book of all when I was a child was Ballet Shoes. And when I think about it now, I think to have an Uncle Gum in my life as a child would have just been heavenly. I don't think I quite understood that at the time. But when I think about that book now and the kind of fractured family and these kind of people who are not really related looking after those girls, and having kind of Mad Uncle Gum as absent as he was, nonetheless, that kind of eccentric. I think I always want, when I was a child, I just wanted a kind of eccentric, avuncular figure in my life who would do slightly mad things.
Almost like a sort of a slightly more real god who's there and looking out for you. So, non-reviewing novels here.
No, so these might these might have all been reviewed. So a lot of these have been reviewed, but I love them enough to keep them, or they're books that I haven't
these
yet.
These are books you want to kind of to keep and, yes, and have in your life.
So, you know, we have Elizabeth Strout, who I adore. And who has another book coming out this year, which I'm super, super excited about.
I see. And so over here, the other side, got I spotted this.
I did the last interview with Jackie Collins before she died.
Wow. I didn't know that. That is so this is, was this her last book?
That was her last book.
And then very careful with it. This is called Thrill. And
actually,
it's a celebration.
No, that's not her last book.
I want to talk about Thrill because it's a celebration edition. The says Jackie Collins Thrill in leopard print font. And there's, is that a panther on the front?
Let me have a look. I'm just getting another one down for you. What is that one?
So this is...
Well, it's some kind of big cat, isn't it, that looks quite predatory.
Big gold sexy cat. And the cover quote is Jilly Cooper.
Who you love.
Favourite of the podcast. A true inspiration, a trailblazer for women's fiction.
So the reason I keep these, that one and this, is because since she died, every edition now has my interview with her in the back.
Oh, that's
transcribed.
So cool. So are you in this one as well?
I think that's the reason I kept that one. Let's have a look. Yes, there we go. There's the interview in that one as well. Because I hadn't read much Jackie Collins before.
I've just opened up this. It's people like Miley Cyrus and Rihanna, and they're all doing their own thing, and they're seizing their lives. Like, all the models now are bisexual because it suits them. I can't work out how she feels about that from that quote.
I'm not sure I knew by the end of the interview.
Where did you go? Did you go to Hollywood?
No. She was over for promotion for this book, which is the Santangelos, which was the final chapter of her series. And so it was at the Marriott Hotel, organised by Simon and Schuster. I was told to go and meet her in her suite at a very particular time before the event, and I think I wore a black dress,
elegant and classy, because I guess, you know, I'm trying to think, you can't wore. Whatever you wear, she'll be in basically in the chandelier. She's sort of like the literary Lady Gaga.
Well, except she, because I think, I don't know if it's because I didn't know she was ill at the time. I mean, she literally died like 6 days later, so I remember her being very thin, but I think she wore a jacket and a skirt, actually, just quite smart.
Not a sort of Diamante birdcage.
No.
I mean, because she...
Big hair. Lots of big hair.
She didn't... Am I right in thinking that she didn't really share that information with anyone?
No.
Before she died. And I was always wondering whether it was partly a generational thing of that being something that you didn't talk about or wouldn't have talked about when she was growing up, or whether it's to do with her as someone who was so, so glamorous, of wanting to absolutely be in control of sort of the perception of her and not wanting to be publicly vulnerable.
I wonder whether she was just a trooper. I mean, that was the sense that when the news came out, a week later, that she died, and I thought back to that interview.
That must have been such a shock.
It was a massive shock. I mean, huge. My sense was that she was just a kind of, good old fashioned, you keep the show on the road. Mm. And I'm committed to doing these events, and I have a book to promote, and I will go out there and promote them. I mean, just the kind of consummate professionalism of that, knowing that you are very, very ill. I mean, I don't know how ill she knew she was at that point, even.
Have you ever had a sort of a period of block? Because I get the impression that, like Jackie Collins, you're constantly working, you're constantly...
I am of the school of thought that you sit at your desk each day and you do stuff. And even if you write words that are terrible... You need to write some words, and even if they're going to be deleted, you have to kind of, I mean, everybody works differently, I know, but for me, for my own kind of sense of professional self-esteem almost, I have to do something every day. And the fact is, if I'm, I suppose in a way it's a bit of a cheat, because if I know that I'm struggling slightly on novel stuff, there is always reviews to write or events to prep. So I can always do stuff, which is work, if I'm, you know, as a diversion from creative writing, if I'm struggling with that. But I am, I mean, if I'm on a work week where I have set this week, the week aside to do novel writing, and I'm struggling, which I do often, I will sit and I will just write and write and write. And even if I know it's absolutely terrible and it will get deleted, I still write.
Because you talked a little bit when we were organising this about your routine. You said, you know, I'm up at 7 every day. So is that, you go to your desk and you sit there at 7 and you...
Yes. So my husband and daughter leave at 7:10, which is brilliant because I'm a morning person. So, I mean, 7 is late for me. So sort of 2 or 3 years ago, I would normally get up at like 3:30 when before my daughter went to school. And so I was doing much more kind of daytime childcare. I would get up about 3:30, write for 2 or 3 hours until she got up. And then, you know, write again later when she went to nursery or whatever. Whereas now they're out of the house at 7. So I'm at my desk. So I'm showered and dressed and coffee made and everything. I'm at my desk about 7:10. And then I work till about 2:30 when I have to go and do school pickup. And then I basically do kind of like parenthood from 2:30 till about 7:30. And then I work again from about 7:30 to about 10:30.
Oh, wow. So that's
that's why I have no social life. People keep on saying, so I didn't go out socially once last year that wasn't work related. And when I say that to people, they look at me as if to say, "In it, either you're just very tragic or I don't quite believe you." But it's because I work every evening.
Can we talk about your new book, which I think will probably be out when this goes out, yes, or very, very close to it? It is called If Only I Could Tell You, which I did know, but I had to double check.
It's funny because I've got multiple copies on the shelf, so you had like multiple opportunities to remind yourself.
So I could put the eyes in the wrong place.
To be fair, you did read it a long time ago.
I did read it a while ago, and I really, really loved it. I found it moving, and I think because I just love stories about families. And what I loved about it so much is it's far from sort of idealised family. It's about feeling all that sort of, you know, love and jealousy and attention and pressure. And I don't want to do too many spoilers, but it really kind of, you know, it sort of, there were so many moments that made my heart swell and made me go, oh, and do little sort of sad gasps.
I mean, the thing about kind of like the family book for me, you know, there are lots of critics and writers who say, you know, writing about family is domestic and small-minded, and, you know, it's a, you know, what women write about is family, and men write about big ideas and politics and things. And for me, the family is the place where you learn all your formative relationships, and you learn how to behave around other people and negotiate things and emote and or not, as the case may be. And so for me, the family is the kind of cornerstone of the kind of individuals that people are going to be where they end up in society in 20 or 30 years time. Like, you know, that's where we form our view of relationships. So to me, writing about the family is kind of absolutely at the heart of writing about society and the kind of people, the ways that people develop. So,
and also, you know, politically, you can sort of say, I'm going to write about grand ideas. Like 99% of people, even if they're, you know, big grand shouty writers, they will have no bearing on those events. Whereas everybody has some kind of a family or, yes, a family type relationship, yeah, in their life, whether it's, you know, full of love or full of pain, or I think most of us somewhere in between.
Yes. And I mean, if you look at something like, just a quick diversion, if you look at something like Jonathan Coe's Middle England, which is, you know, hailed as the first Brexit novel, and it is brilliant, and it's, you know, the political backdrop is there, and politically it's very astute and insightful. But essentially, it's about families and relationships and marriages falling apart and difficult parents and siblings. You know, that's what drives that narrative. Is not how we're feeling about the referendum. What drives the narrative is kind of people's emotional reactions to the referendum and the conflicts that come out of it.
But I've just finished Aisha Malik's The Screen in Pleasant Land, which is coming out this summer. And again, that's a book, I don't know if you've read it yet, you're much more disciplined than I am and reading things in order, whereas I'm just that. But I thought it was fantastic and really a sort of a big book and a small book. And it's big because it's sort of about the clash between, I think, you know, what it's like to be a Muslim living in the UK, and about racism and small-mindedness and why people are racist and people failing to understand each other and people sort of struggling to kind of to be compassionate. And it's about identity, and it's very grown up, but it really, all of that comes about because it's the exploration of a family and different families and that kind of fragmentation.
And otherwise,
definitely recommend it.
Otherwise, you would not be drawn into that narrative and those characters.
Shall we go?
Shall we go downstairs?
Yeah.
Are we going to work downwards in sequential order?
Yeah. So this is the bookshelf outside Hannah's daughter's room.
So she's very lucky, because I was reviewing children's books as well. She has basically more books than most public libraries. So she's got like close on 2,000 books. So this is basically, this is her kind of secondary bookshelf. So in her room...
Oh, these pictures are beautiful.
She, again, lovely illustrators have sent her original artwork over the years. So we've got Rob Biddulph and Beth Woolvin and Clara Villiamy, who is Shelley Hughes' daughter, and Oliver Jeffers and Benji Davis. So she has all this amazing artwork. So now she's now six, so she's on kind of, you know, the Enid Blytons
and the Harry Potters.
She's about all the Roald Dahls she's worked through.
I love those Neil Stratfield reissues.
I haven't read them yet. I've given them straight to her.
Applebough. Gosh, I get them confused because they are... There's a sort of certain kind of rhythm her stories follow. Or is it Caldecott Player? No, I think it is Applebough. It's about someone in the family, a child who's discovered to be a prodigy, a musical prodigy, and they sort of say, they go all around the world, you know, following his career, and he's got a manager, and but all the children want is to come back home, and it's about that, really. It's really simple, but oh, it's gorgeous. Oh, Hannah, do you still read to her?
I do. It's really interesting. So she became a kind of independent, she's quite a kind of precocious reader, so she became an independent reader about a year ago, and what's interesting is that she now reads kind of chapter books for kind of 9 to 10 year olds, but she wants me to read picture books to her, the kind of books we read when she was sort of 3 or 4 to
so
her
these
at bedtime.
Books down here.
No, so these, they? So what she likes reading in bed by herself often is, you know, things like Blue Planet or David Attenborough's Dynasties or Explanatorium of Nature, or she quite likes reading the Encyclopedia at bedtime to herself.
I'm really taken by that. The Story of Life Evolution. It's got the most beautiful cover. Again, I go, judging.
I have to say, I mean, I don't really have a kind of strong sense of sort of, other than the last 5 years of children's books, but I have a very strong sense of the books that we had when we were kids. And I think non-fiction books for kids now are just so beautiful and so cleverly done. And, you know, my mum was reading Book of Bones with her the other day, and she said, I'm sure if I had books like that when I was a kid, I would have been more interested in biology and
yes.
science, because they're done so inventively and so, you know, beautiful illustrations. And, you know, this book, I'm going to show you this one because it is amazing. So Book of Bones, 10 record-breaking animals. And the way they've done it is you have... like, who is this? And it has the skeleton. And then it has the actual animal. And then you can actually feel the skeleton underneath.
Oh, that's so clever.
So you have a sense of how a skeleton fits inside a body. And they're just really beautifully done. And again, you know, they're tactile and they're beautifully illustrated.
I think I'm going to buy my own copy so I can bone up. Sorry, I cannot resist a terrible pun. I'm going to look at a poem for every day of the year.
So we've basically got sort of two different versions. So that one is a grown-up one that we do read at bedtime.
So this is a Pam Macmillan. I'm going to see. So
the thing that we always do is look up our birthdays first. So look up what's your birthday poem.
Oh, I don't know this poem. It's The Bright Field by R.S. Thomas, a proudly Welsh poet.
So one of our favourites, which happens to be on my birthday, is this, which is today is very boring. And it's about, it's just hilarious. Like for kids, it's just a hilarious poem. It's about someone saying it's really, really boring. And loads of amazing, like ridiculous things are happening. That's a great book. And then this one for kids, I just love. So this came out this Christmas, and it's called I Am the Seed That Grew the Tree. And it's a kid's book, but it's a nature poem for every day of the year. And it's beautifully illustrated.
Oh.
I mean, like, you know, if you're a kid.
That's a lovely thing.
And how would you not get into poetry if you're given a book like that? And the thing that, you know, I think what's really interesting about children and poetry is that I think when you get to, you know, secondary school and you're started to ask about, you know, understand, you know, interpret the poem and, you know, what's the hidden meaning? Well, poetry becomes sort of difficult in a way that it never needs to be. Whereas for kids, the rhythm is almost like just reading a poem, and rhythm and language and rhyme particularly, it's almost like a kind of literary mindfulness for them. So we do read poems before bed every night. And I think there is something genuinely kind of calming about, you know, you've started when they were tiny with Julia Donaldson and, you know, her lovely, which is really poetry, her books. And then you kind of move on to this, to, you know, famous poets. And I think there is something genuinely calming about those rhymes and those rhythms.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
We'll be back to Hannah soon, but now it's time for my steal of the week, a book I loved so much that paying the cover price alone feels like ripping someone off and makes me think we should all send the author some money on PayPal. This week, my steal is Perfect Liars by Rebecca Reid, a chilling, addictive novel about what happens between old school friends when they meet up, having spent years trying to hide a horrible secret. This is a taut, extremely pacey thriller. I don't usually reach for thrillers, but the emotional detail is so sharp and evocative that I loved it. Reid captures the jealousy and anxiety of a toxic friendship brilliantly. And I loved the way she explores the unravelling of failing relationships. That's Perfect Liars, published by Transworld, out now. Now, back to Hannah. Hannah, what room are we in? I see a very impressive... Is that a keyboard or an organ?
No, that's a digital piano that we have left over from before we got the proper piano downstairs.
So, do you play?
I do, yes. Yeah. Yeah, we didn't just get a massively big grand piano for a six-year-old. That would be slightly extreme.
Do you play often? Do you play now?
I play most days. Yeah, it's for me. You know how like lots of people talk about like going for a run or going for a swim, and it releases endorphins and makes them feel relaxed. For me, partly because I'm lazy and I don't want to go for a swim or a run.
Fair enough.
Piano is my version of that. It's my version of kind of mindfulness.
God, it's such a lovely thing to do with your hands.
What, playing the piano?
Yeah.
Yes.
Have you played all your life?
I started the flute first when I was about eight or nine, and then started the piano when I was about 10 or 11, and then did a lot of music. You know, I nearly went to music college instead of university. I was kind of very musical. And then my mum very sensibly said, you can do music as a hobby your whole life, but you need to get a proper job. So this is a bit of a motley bookcase, if I'm honest. So we're now in the playroom, which is also the room that we kind of hang out in. We're on the first floor of the house. And this is the room that we kind of tend to hang out in the evenings. So it's a bit of a mishmash room because it's got all my daughter's toys in. It's got lots of her books.
So there's an amazing range of, I see children's books. What are these? Little People, Big Dreams.
Oh, they're wonderful.
These look gorgeous.
There's about 40 of them now.
Squashing a
So they are very...
So, let's look at the Agatha Christie one.
Okay,
really
do the
fun.
Agatha Christie one. I'm always surprised in all these things when Coco Chanel comes up. It's like, why is Coco Chanel in all of the kind of feminist, you know, people you should aspire to be like?
I don't know who wrote it, but it's a, you know, for teenage girls, like brilliant feminist heroes to read about. And Audrey Hepburn's one. And...
Oh, there's an Audrey here.
Oh, is there?
Yeah, Audrey's here.
Oh, maybe this is what someone was talking about. And I think, well, look, I can see the appeal, but at the same time, I'm sure there are quite a few other...
who are above her in the list. Mm. So they're just brilliantly graphic books. I think they're all...
Oh, little Agatha and her mum read a book together every afternoon. Agatha always had a better idea for how the story should end. Mm. Have there any books, classic books or other books, where you think... That's not how I would have done it, where you've got an idea for how you'd rewrite the ending.
Oh, golly, no. I mean, you do ask some quite difficult questions.
I do.
I struggle to remember what I read last week, let alone books. I remember when I was a teenager starting to get frustrated about the kind of happily ever after ending. You know that thing that you, when you're a bit older and a bit more sophisticated and you understand much more explicitly that the story doesn't end when the people... kiss for the first time or even get married. And I think when I was a teenager, I did start getting a sense of that's not really the end of the story, which is not to say that I would think that I should rewrite, you know, the end of Pride and Prejudice.
But that, I mean, I do think about that a bit with, you know, the Brontes, you know, utterly brilliant, you know, some of the greatest writers who's ever lived. But you do think, I don't think these relationships are going to be happy or untroubled. you're off with a fairly terrible man who's got psychological problems.
Yes. And in fact, there was, I can't remember where it was, but there was a piece of research only about a week or two ago about how damaging it is for, you know, girls and young women to be reading these happily ever after stories where things end with people getting married or, you know, having the first kiss, because A, obviously it's very reductive in terms of their options, but also it's the beginning of the story, it's not the end.
Absolutely. And I think it's so, so interesting that, because I'm really interested in relationships, real ones and imaginary ones, but it's rare to get the meat of a relationship. It either, we're so interested in the beginning and the ending, but the lifetime in between, which is the richest bit, nobody seems to kind of fully explore or care about. There's a good friend of mine, a writer I really love. I think she's really, really entertaining and funny, Lucy Vine, who writes fabulous romantic comedies. And I think nearly all of her books sort of end with the heroine being kind of happily single, or, you know, there'll be romance and she'll be sort of pursued and pursued, but sort of ends up saying, you know what, actually, I'm fine. Yeah. This is fine. I'm not going to try and force this into a relationship because you're, you know, not
damaged.
So great. Yeah.
Yes.
It's a beautiful edition of something. I can't
think that might be Tennyson. It's one of my grandparents.
Tennyson Select Poems. Yeah. I love it. It's leather bound. So did you inherit this?
So that is Beatrice Beckerman. That is my great, great aunt.
Oh, wow. This is, I've got proper gilt out pages and everything.
Well, look, you open it on The Lady of Shalott. Of course you do, lady.
I'm disappointed in myself for being quite so obvious. I studied Tennyson at A-level and I loved him so, so, so much. And I was just thinking about getting poems in your head. And with me, it's always Mariana and Oh, she said, my life is dreary. He cometh not, she said. No, I am aweary. I would that I were dead. And it's just the most gloriously teen emo kind of.
It's funny, isn't it? That stuff that you learn when you're a child that you can remember, like 30 years later, that, I mean, if I tried to memorise a long poem now, it would take me weeks and weeks and weeks to do it. So, yeah, so here we have, you know, we have Shakespeare, we have Brecht, we have bits and bobs of poetry. But this is this side is essentially kind of fiction on a non-fiction from the last. I've got non-fiction and fiction combined here, which pains me, but I just haven't had time to sort it out. So this is from the last sort of 4 or 5 years that just hasn't made it downstairs to the A1 bookshelf.
I see. And so over here, the other side, got floor-to-ceiling books on both ends. So I spotted this earlier. There's a shelf, I see, emergency sex and Greek island hopping.
Yeah, both my husband's. I hasten to add. This is basically, I suppose, this is our kind of brainy shelves. So these are all of the books left over from academic days of studying psychoanalytic theory and critical theory and film theory and feminism, and they're books that I probably haven't picked up for the best part of 25 years, but I'm hoping that at some point in the next decade they will provide some inspiration to my daughter.
So this is a mix of your books and your husband's books. Were you ever sort of studying together? Were you studying
No, he's things? 7 years younger than me. We didn't meet each other he was in his 20s and I was in my 30s. But we actually grew up very near to each other, and we worked out that when I was kind of going to discos not far from his house, he was, you know, doing crosswords and, you know, playing computer games. So these are mostly mine. You know, the kind of economic textbooks on the other side are all his, but all the psychoanalytic theory. And
gosh, it's funny, isn't it? I think my eyes just sort of blanked and you kind of, oh, that looks like maths. So do you give each other books?
He is not a huge fiction reader. He reads, basically we have a competition each year. So he reads loads and loads and loads of political articles online. And at the end, so he saves them all to that app called Pocket. You need to use that, which is brilliant. I love Pocket. So every time someone sends me an article, I just save it straight to Pocket, and then I know that I've got it for later. So Pocket tells him at the end of the year how many words he's read. And obviously I keep a list of all the books I've read, and I kind of average it out at like 100,000 words a book. So we have a competition at the end of each year to see who... God, this makes us sound so tragic!
No, I bet you do. You always win.
No, we're usually on a par.
Oh, really?
I mean, I usually pip him to the post just very slightly, but we're normally kind of sort of around sort of 1.5 million words each year. I do give him books, but I have to be very selective because he's quite... The Venn diagram of where we overlap is quite small. So he, for instance, will read stuff like Ian M. Banks, which I would just never read in a million years. So I love Ian Banks, but just wouldn't really want to do Ian M. Banks. So we cross over on things like, you know, I've just given him his first Maggie O'Farrell, which he loved. So obviously, she is one of my favourite writers of all time and one of my favourite humans.
Which one was it that you...
I gave him This Must Be the Place.
Ah.
So... The most recent and, you know, stylistically brilliant. So we cross over on stuff like, you know, the McEwans and the William Boyds and those kind of sort of elder statesmen. God, would they hate me for saying elder statesmen? They're all in their 50s or 60s, aren't they?
I think they'd probably be cross if you didn't.
We cross over on those quite a lot. In fact, I've just given him Tessa Hadley Late in the Day, which I have just finished. And oh my goodness, it's sublime. It's so brilliant.
I've never read any Tessa Hadley.
It was my first. It was my first. And I had so many people on Twitter had said it's amazing. And in fact, that was a book for pleasure when I was ill last week. And I could read stuff for pleasure. That's the first book that I've read for ages that was just out of choice. And then obviously we have the kind of the wish fulfillment travel bookshelf, which is mostly places we have been to, but it is kind of there to remind us that we are now in kind of suburban parenthood, no longer kind of globetrotting.
I can't believe you haven't mentioned my complete collection of Freud.
They've even got their spines cracked. They're not even there just for show.
Because Freud would have a lot to say about you wanting us to notice the Freud. But I didn't mention that. So you did English.
I did.
And then did you go on to do psychology or...
No. So as my... when I was doing... I basically didn't like anything pre-20th century literature when I was doing English, which was a bit of a problem. But from the second and third year, you could basically... I was at King's in London, and you could basically choose your modules to make sure you didn't do anything other than 20th century. And there are a couple of lecturers there that were just big on psychoanalytic theory and critical theory and feminist theory. So basically I just did a lot of that. So everything was through a psychoanalytic feminist prism that I read and wrote about. And then when I did my MA, I did basically like sort of 20th century literature MA. And so carried on doing a lot of psychoanalytic theory. And I know Freud is very unfashionable in lots of ways, but he is the father of psychoanalysis, and I will always genuflect before the altar of my Freud shelf.
What are these?
So this is, I mean, as I say, there is a structure to this. So this is the shelf above the airing cupboard, and I just suddenly realised one day this is a shelf that is not used. So this is
very much like, you know, I'm writing with my feet in the kitchen sink, I'm reading by reaching above the airing cupboard.
So this is just a continuation of the alphabeticising that started in the playroom and will continue in the study upstairs. So we've got Laurie Moore here, and then I think Claire McIntosh starts upstairs. Which isn't actually alphabetical at all, is it? Because that's M-O and M-A.
It's interesting looking at the spine of This Is Going to Hurt by Adam Kay, which is sort of a mega, mega hit book. And, you know, I think of that as being a very new book, but that looks, the way it's sort of displayed being kind of the paperback, and I think that...
So that
primrose
proof.
Yellow.
That is the proof.
That looks like it could be from sort of, it could be 20 years old, just from seeing
the
spine.
Well, that's probably because it's been around so many people's houses. So
is that one that you've been kind of pressing into people's hands?
Yeah, I don't think there's anyone in my extended family who hasn't had that copy, because I got it in a long time before publication, loved it on site, became kind of a huge champion for him and that book, and yeah, pressed it into so many people's hands, which is why it does look like it's 20 years. But you're right, the colours on it do look like kind of an almost like a kind of old penguin or something.
Yeah,
don't they?
Really. I'm thinking about seeing, you know, spines on, you know, my parents' bookshelves.
Yeah,
like, things from sort of, you know, the, I guess the late 80s that have been read. It's got that real, just like a contemporary classic. Like,
yes,
and it is next to the.
Hardback.
I'm not going to touch anymore because it's all going to fall down. The beautiful hardback looks very
shiny
and new.
Which I think hasn't been touched because it's one of those, you know, when you, after you've had, I very rarely create proofs and hardbacks because there's just not room. But when you really love a book, then I do.
Well, in the sitting room, it's a beautiful grand piano. It really is a gorgeous piano.
What no one told me before we got it is that gloss black is really terrible for dust.
I mean, it looks very, very shiny.
Yeah, that's because my daughter reminded me to dust it yesterday, and she, because she's the right height, she was like, no, you missed a bit, missed a bit. I was like, I've got to dust it.
Useful and quite irritating. Oh, you shouldn't have done it on my account, but it is...
It was filthy.
Utterly lovely. So let's have a look at books. I'm going to try and go around the stool. So I can see a wide range of Maggie O'Farrell's.
Always lots of Maggie.
I see Ali Smith. I see Zadie Smith. Yes, you weren't kidding about this. It's definitely... Smiths are together. So you've got an A to Z of Smiths.
I think I alphabeticised this when I was overdue for childbirth. And we just had these shelves built. And... everyone kept on saying, you've got to keep busy, you've got to keep busy, and then the baby will come. So I painted all these shelves and alphabetised all the books, and it was one of those kind of just desperate time-filling activities. But I was really, really fascistic about making sure they were properly alphabetised. So if you find something that's wrong, I will be heartbroken.
Oh, good. I'm not going to tell you.
You are, aren't you? You're going to now make it your mission to try and find something that's out of sync.
A writer I really, really love, and it's that sort of mentionitis thing, isn't it? If you don't notice something, and then it's all you see. Doris Lessing has been mentioned, and I was surprised that she'd not come up before, but I see you've got masses of Doris Lessing.
I have got masses. So I read The Golden Notebook when I was probably 16, and it was, without a doubt, my kind of awakening moment into feminism. Undoubtedly.
I do think that is a book. Actually, that's a, someone's asked me to recommend some, I think it's 16 books for their 16-year-old daughter. And the ones I thought of were Brother of the More Famous Jack and Dead Avocado, but I think The Golden Notebook, or maybe Martha Quest would be there.
I gave The Golden Notebook to one of my nieces when she turned 16. I gave her like 5 books for her 16th birthday that I thought were kind of... I will have to think of them. I can't remember what the other... I think I might have given her a Maggie. I think I gave her a Sarah Waters... Because she, I think I probably, if I probably gave her Tipping the Velvet. But no, I mean, Doris Lessing, it should, I just think it should be required reading for every kind of teenage and early 20-something girl stroke woman. I mean, it's, you know, stylistically, it's a really interesting, challenging book. But just having that sense of kind of women being in both troubled, but ultimately kind of empowered, for me, was just kind of mind-blowing.
Because, I mean, I really, 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 really love Anita Bruckner. And I know that not everybody does. And I do feel as though Anita Bruckner is sometimes dismissed because the covers aren't great. And there's their books about anxious, shy women sort of being disappointed. But I think there's a lot more wit and spark there. But I think that Martha is almost like the anti-Bruckner heroine, isn't she? Because she's all gumption and guts.
Yeah. And in fact, I think
you need both.
Up there are all, I haven't read them, but there are all her science fiction books as well that I picked up in secondhand shops over the years. And I haven't actually read any of those ones. But again, at some point in retirement, I will get round to them. I have lots of Roth. There's almost a full, half a shelf of Roth. And I know lots of people, lots of women have an issue with Roth, but I adore him.
When did you come to him?
For my master's dissertation was about the representation of the Jewish mother in 20th century literature. And so obviously like one of the centrepieces was Portnoy's Complaint. So I came to him then. So relatively late, 21, I guess. Loved Portnoy's Complaint, then started reading his more recent stuff. You know, I genuinely think that American Pastoral is one of the great novels of the 20th century. And then when I was working TV, I wrote him to ask him to make a documentary for his 70th birthday. And one day my phone rang and this voice said, is that Hannah Beckerman? And I said, yeah. And he said, it's Philip Roth. And we just started these kind of year-long, kind of once a week, hour-long phone calls about his books and his life. And eventually he said, come and make the film. And so we went and spent, you know, 3 days making a film with him.
A very, very deep voice, I'm imagining.
Hello. Yeah, not a particularly deep voice. And I basically was completely in love with him. Like, utterly, like, it didn't matter that I was in her mid-20s and he was 69. If he had said, move here and, you know, move in with me and be my mistress, I would have just said, yeah, fine, I'm there. And when he died last year, and we did keep up a bit of a correspondence, so I have got some letters for him, from him. And when he died last year, I wrote a piece for The Observer about it. And my commissioning editor phoned me up and said, I've just read your piece. Have you read Lisa Halliday's Asymmetry? And I said, no, I haven't even heard of it. And he said, well, it's basically your story, but where they do end up having the thing. And I was so jealous.
With Philip Roth?
Yeah.
So is it a memoir?
It's a novel, but it's a it's a loosely fictionalized autobiography.
Wow. So do you sort of wish that you'd perhaps made a move?
Well, I sort of wonder, I just feel slightly disappointed because obviously we had this kind of year-long conversation, the conversations on the phone, and then obviously he was a bit disappointed when I got there.
I'm sure that's not the case at all, but how interesting that sliding doors moment is. Yes. Where, and you want to believe, don't you, that obviously if that had happened, then maybe all the good things that are going on now perhaps wouldn't have.
Yeah, I don't, when I look back now as a 43-year-old woman, I don't really wish that I'd had an affair with Philip Roth when I was in my mid-20s.
And I imagine it was that the possibility was the most thrilling part.
Right, no, I think it's almost that proximity thing, that proximity to greatness thing. It's a bit like, you know, what we were saying about the kind of Freud books or the critical theory and all of that stuff that I haven't read for years. And you were talking about the possibility of it.
Yes.
And I think there is also a part of me that kind of thinks just by osmosis, by having all these books around me, it somehow just naturally is enriching. And I think there was something about the Philip Roth thing that I think I just wanted to be touched, not necessarily physically, but touched by greatness.
Physically touched by greatness. That's a good book title.
How excited are you that David Nichols has got a new one out?
Oh, I know.
Like beyond excited.
I just think David Nichols is one of the funniest writers working, I was going to say in the English language, I don't know anyone who's very, very funny in like French or Welsh. But the things I always think of that are, as a line that something like Suki would probably start a letter of condolence with, wahey, and the only time Ian, the aspiring stand-up comic, and the only time Ian had ever made Emma laugh was when he'd fallen down the stairs.
Yeah. I mean, he's such a humane writer as well. I mean, did you see Patrick Melrose?
I've not seen it. I've only...
This is so brilliant. You, I mean, it's...
Must.
It is genuinely the best thing I have seen on TV in years. And his scripts are just sublime. I mean, you know, I love those Patrick Melrose books. And I was really, really nervous, even when I knew David was doing it, because adaptations can often be so, like, so disappointing. And it's just a wonderful, brilliant piece of TV.
I wonder whether, because I think I've read the first three and I thought they were fantastic. And this is a controversial thing to say, and I think I've said it before, I'm going to get into trouble one day. And there was so much to love about that, but definitely with the third one, I'm going to come back to these books and I will love them and I will learn and I'll figure it out. But I get... I'm a very, 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 very slow reader of Anthony Powell. I've only just learned that it is pronounced Powell, not Powell.
Which one? Was that Nina Stibbe who told you
yes,
that?
Yes, I think it was.
I remember in the podcast.
But the name dropping, like, oh, look, Buttons has come in and he's selling a communist newspaper and he's with that woman who someone had an affair with in the last book. And it's like going to a really, that sort of dreary, dreary name dropping. And I think, what's the third Patrick Melrose book?
I'm going to have a look.
They're here, aren't they?
Some Hope. I mean, I think what I love about the Patrick Melrose books is that they, like, emotionally, I found them so raw and brutal and hard going in a way that I sort of felt like I needed to go through because he had, you know. So I mean, I love them. But the TV series is dark. I recommended it to a friend who's off sick at the moment and she texted me saying, you didn't tell me it was going to be quite that dark.
So
now we're on what we're on my shelf, which is A, we're A to K.
A to K. So we start with... Ali,
Chinua Achebe,
Gilbert
Adair, and we end with Ivan Klima.
I can see lots of top feminist literature. Oh, you've got Family and Friends, Anita Bruckner. I see Kate Chopin, Marilyn French. Are these from
these are all books that I read in my kind of university phase. Yeah, I mean, I would say from kind of 16 to 24, I immersed myself in kind of feminist writing and feminist fiction. And then I just became sort of, you know, more of a generalist after that. So, but I mean, you know, at the same time, like, you know, there's loads of Raymond Chandler there and Raymond Carver, you know, all of this is all stuff
Raymonds.
That...
All the Raymonds. Organised according to Raymond.
I mean, we were talking earlier about how we don't really like crime or read crime much. You know, Raymond Chandler is an exception to that. I mean, he is an exceptional writer. And there is a darkness and a depth to characters there that is just brilliant.
Absolutely. And I think as well, an aspect of the poetic. It's as much like reading poetry as anything else, because he's such an economist. Well, talking earlier about forever and you all being in it together and passing it around, I read American Psycho when I was about 13 and it was on my parents' spare shelf and I couldn't tell anyone I was reading it because I wasn't supposed to. And holy Mary, was I ever scared.
And
it was
too much.
Did you
need to talk to someone about it? Yes.
I really did. Gorgeous Bloody Chamber by Angela
Carter.
Wow.
Signed first edition that my siblings bought for me for my 21st birthday.
What an incredible gift. It cost £85.
It was. It would probably be slightly more than that now, because 21st birthday was quite a long time ago. Oh, was it not signed? Is it?
Yes, year ago, surely. And oh, what's so lovely as well about Angela Carter's signature is probably quite easy to fake. I mean, sure, obviously this is authenticated, but under her name, it's just Angela Carter, written in
a biro that's running out.
A biro that's running out. Very kind of neatly and sort of very, very, very legibly.
It's quite teacherly writing.
Yes.
Yeah. And the wavy C line, yes, underneath.
And she's not done that thing of crossing out her own name, writing underneath. Do you do that?
What is that thing? It's only in the last year or so that I've clocked that that's what authors do. Is that what you're supposed to do as an author?
I had a conversation with Nina about this a while ago and she rolled her eyes and said it's like men do it. And I don't know if there's some, I am writing my name better than the publisher can, because I have no idea. It's a weird
convention. Do you need to cross out one name in order to write your other? I was studying Angela Carter at university. We were doing books to film, so we were doing the Bloody Chamber. I mean, she is, in terms of kind of like feat of imagination, she is just wonderful, isn't she?
It's just, I must say, it's like the most stunning cover too.
It is, isn't it?
You've got a
the nails on the wolf. I mean, that is terrifying.
And a beautiful topless lady with kind of mermaid snaky hair, and she got a unicorn horn.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's supposed to be.
I don't know if she's supposed to be, or it's a bit of hair. Maybe it's it's the wolf's jaw, isn't it?
Where?
And I think that line there. So we'll. The head. It's. I know. I need the bone book. That would help me.
Yes.
Huge, huge thanks to the fabulous Hannah. Read If Only I Could Tell You immediately. It's out now, published by Orion, but do be warned that it will make you cry. If you're reading it on a train, try to make sure you've got plenty of tissues on you and you're not sharing a carriage with a school trip. Follow Hannah at Hannah Beckerman on Twitter, at Hannah Beckerman Author on Instagram, and share the love with her. I'm Daisy Buchanan. Thank you so much for joining me, fellow Tome Raiders. You can find me on Twitter at NotRollerGirl and on Instagram at TheDaisyBee. Say hello, suggest some guests and watch out for shelfies. Visit our show page, acast.com/booked, for more information about our guests and a list of the books they've talked about. If you have any other queries about the podcast, you can email us at ybooked@gmail.com. Your Booked is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. Please do subscribe, rate us, and leave a review. It's great to hear what you think, and it helps other people find the podcast. I'll see you next time. And meanwhile, don't forget what John Waters said. If you go home with somebody and they don't have books, don't fuck them.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.